So we are speaking with Max Wilbert of Deep Green Resistance Seattle. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and also about Deep Green Resistance on the west side of Washington?
Sure. Thanks for having me on, Helen. Really appreciate it. So, as you said, my name is Max Wilbert. I grew up in Seattle. I actually live down in Eugene, Oregon right now, but I've lived in Bellingham and a lot of different places in western Washington over the years. And I got involved in activism at a pretty young age in Seattle, mostly focused on doing racism work, and became an environmentalist and became involved with Deep Green Resistance around 2010 or 2011. And so as a group, we are looking at strategies to halt the destruction of the planet. And for the most part, we see that things are getting worse. So the question is, how do we respond to that? And, you know, our personal approach is that when things aren't getting better, then we may need a different approach. So we advocate for strategy and more militant resistance. We actually are pretty open in our call for eco-sabotage and things like that. And those are tactics that we explore in our media and on our websites. And there's a book that the movement is based on. And so, yeah, we're looking at how to turn the tide, how to turn things around. And so I'm interested in the history of social movements and looking at how different parts of movements interact and support one another, pushing towards the overall goals. And when you look at a lot of historical resistance movements, you see a broad diversity of tactics being used. One great example is the struggle against apartheid in South Africa. You know, you had the boycott, you had huge international pressure, you had, musicians and sports teams refusing to go there. And then on the other hand, you had organizing and agitation within the country, public protests, and economic sabotage to force them to stop that system. So that's sort of the brief intro, and we can talk more if you have specific questions.
Okay, yeah. Of course, we would like to focus on the big action that happened over about 10 days ago in Bellingham. As we shared on the last show, there's several articles that folks that are listening might want to check out on the Deep Green Resistance Seattle website. One, of course, the first one, which has lots of info all the way back to the beginning moments of blockade of a coal train just south of Bellingham. According to that article, which is entitled Activists Stage Coal Train Blockade in Bellingham, Train Stopped for 12 Hours, on Saturday, August 27th, activists for ecological defense blocked northbound Burlington Northern Santa Fe coal train for 12 hours at the Chuckanuck Bay Railroad Bridge south of Bellingham, Washington, in an effort to directly halt the transportation of coal en route for shipment overseas. So if you could, share just, based on articles and such that are already up and circulating among the public, although not enough, we understand from your website that there really hasn't been enough news coverage of this very valiant endeavor to save our planet from climate change via all the fossil fuel transports across our region. If you could tell us a little more about, everything that happened, just the various steps that are already pretty well known, I think, at least among activists at this point, of that particular action.
Right, sure. So, yeah, on this was a week from this past Saturday, so coming up on 10 days ago, and it was up in Bellingham. Like I said, I lived there for years, and some local activists, along with some people from across the region, organized a blockade there. And so the train was stopped for 12 hours, and I think part of the reason for that was just trying to be really strategic in terms of the location that was chosen. The blockade actually happened on a, not really a trestle, but sort of a causeway across a bay just south of Bellingham. So surrounded on both sides by water and out in the middle of this bay. So a highly visible position and a position that made it difficult for the police to bring in forces and equipment from the side. They basically had to bring what they wanted down the track. So Spencer, who is Bellingham resident, climbed up a tripod on this causeway, and he's facing three charges, trespassing, second-degree trespassing, resisting arrest, although, of course, the resistance that occurred, if there was any, was just passive resistance. He essentially didn't come down when they asked him to. And the third charge is obstructing a railway, which is, I believe, a Washington state law. So it was a strategic location because anything, any tools that the cops needed had to be brought down the rail line a few miles from Bellingham. And that may have involved moving other trains, or I'm not sure what exactly it entailed, but there was essentially no police presence at all for the first 2 hours or so, of the blockade. The cops showed up after a couple hours, and mostly just hung around for another couple hours, talking amongst themselves and on their radios, trying to figure out what to do. And eventually, it was getting pretty late in the evening. I think the blockade went up at 4 o'clock, and it was probably after 10 by the time that some bigger extraction equipment showed up. They brought in some trucks from north on the tracks, and they brought in a large saw, like some sort of concrete cutting saw is my guess. And they sawed through the legs of the tripod. This was a metal tripod, steel legs, and they sawed through those sort of bit by bit, moving around from each leg in a circle, cutting off, you know, 6-inch or foot-long chunks at a time, and lowering him down to the ground. And so that took a while to get him down, and that was about 8 hours all told. And then right when that blockade was just about finished, the police were informed that a second blockade had gone into effect. Two more activists had locked down further south onto the actual coal train itself, which was stopped just south of the tripod. And so then the cops had to go search the train, find these activists, and then once again find a location to stage their equipment, carry it down a trail, and it took a further about 4 hours to clear those two people out. They were arrested as well and got the same charges, and the train started moving again after about 12 hours. So in terms of the effectiveness of this action, we were relatively pleased. In any action, there's always things that can go better and things that can be improved for next time. I don't think any of us expected them to saw through the metal tripod legs. I've heard of them doing that before with wood tripods, but we didn't expect it with metal, so we weren't prepared for that. But we were pretty pleased. We thought it was a pretty long-lasting blockade, and that was really our goal. You know, I think there was a time and a place for symbolic action, and symbolism is really powerful, and, you know, we need symbolism, we need stories, we need inspiration and all that. But at the end of the day, you know, the planet isn't being killed for lack of stories. It's being killed because the fossil fuels are still flowing. So the goal of the action was to stop the train, stop the coal directly. And there was, I believe, 20 million pounds of coal in that train. So stop it for as long as possible. And compared to other blockades that we've seen. We felt like it went pretty well, and we're hoping a lot more people are going to be doing this sort of thing in the future.
All right. So I just would like to interject. I don't know if you heard, but it might have been the very first blockades of any kind of fossil fuel traffic on rail lines happened in the Portland vicinity. Sonny Glover, G-L-O-V-E-R, was up on a tripod, I think, for about 12 hours. And they did something very similar. And this would have been, I want to say, a couple summers ago. It was just before the Bellingham blockade outside of the refineries that everybody gathered to protest during the Break Free Pacific Northwest action back in mid-May this year. But they also sawed down the bottoms of her tripod as well. I think it was also metal. But I looked into that recently because she was up there for a long time, too. I want to say probably about 12 hours. It was only herself that ended up getting arrested. But so what most people fear in terms of train blockades, and I can say this from being on the front lines and always monitoring fossil fuel traffic and letting down track comrades know when full loads of both Bakken crude and tar sands crude and Powder River Basin coal are coming through. People are afraid that they're going to get hit by a train. And ironically, some young man, 23, was walking along the tracks, I want to say about 5 miles north of Sandpoint and Ponderay, and was actually hit by a train the day after we did a great flotilla action, albeit only 5 people, around some of our very dangerous cracked rail bridges over tributaries and the main Lake Ponderay here. And that instills more fear in people when, you know, some people go out and do an action and then the next day somebody is just hit by a train and killed at a major intersection. So we noticed in some of the videos that you had somebody on the tracks just ahead of the train that was waving, something relatively bright to get the attention of the train and get it to stop. And we also know from an interview with the media person for the Spokane blockade, which happened on the Wednesday after your Saturday blockade, that they had alerted the rail line that, you know, there was a blockade happening in the tracks. Did you take that latter tactic to let the railroad know that that somebody was out there so that they wouldn't be hit, or?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, it's a real danger, and you know, the saying in the movement against, you know, quote unquote domestic abuse or battering is it only takes one good beating a year to keep a woman down. And the idea is essentially, you know, the threat of violence is often more effective than the actual violence. You don't need to do that much violence in order to make everyone afraid. And you know, we haven't seen activists hit with trains in this country recently, but you don't have to look that far back. You know, protests against Vietnam and such. There's a gentleman who lives up in Portland who his leg was cut off by a train when he was doing a train blockade against military shipments. And, you know, so we're getting all kinds of comments on our on media sites and such, saying from belligerent people saying should have just run him over, you know, throw those dash nines into notch eight, which essentially means pedal to the metal, and make hamburger out of them. Sorry, I got a plane going over here, but you know, that's the attitude a lot of people have, and that's the same attitude a lot of people have towards the planet in general. You know, essentially grind it up. That's, you know, the faster the better. So it's a real danger, and activists have to take serious steps to mitigate that danger. You know, obviously we don't want anybody to get hurt if they don't have to. We want to make the action as effective as possible without any casualties, any injuries. But you know, at the same time, I think we got to recognize that this is essentially a war that we're in. You know, this culture is conducting a war against the planet, and there are lots of casualties happening now, so we do need people to take risks and be willing to go out on the front lines and do these things. So that said, in terms of the actual tactics, there's some information circulating among activists throughout the region and beyond about the best way to stay safe when doing these things. And, you know, it involved contacting the train company, having some backups, communicating in multiple different ways, having people down the line potentially looking, you know, looking physically with phones or radios or walkie-talkies, just keeping an eye on things so that, you know, it can be confirmed that the train is actually stopped. So I believe in this case what happened was the train stopped and confirmation was received that the train was stopped, and then the train started moving again, and it was just creeping along very slowly, but it was moving. And when you have 20 million pounds of coal on board, you can't exactly stop rapidly. So I believe what's pictured in the video is one of those sort of secondary methods for making sure that the train actually was going to stop before anybody's life was in imminent danger.
Right, good. Yeah, and it just goes to prove that it really does take a lot of teamwork to keep people safe and to keep eyes on what's going on all around you. So, yeah.
Yeah, I just listened to an interview yesterday of a friend did an interview with Sockage Ward, who's a Mi'kmaq or Mi'kmaq, and he's a member of the Warrior Society and has traveled to a lot of different protests and indigenous land defense actions. And he was just talking about the importance of discipline. And, you know, I think that, you know, I come from the left, you know, I come from the progressive tradition, and we have this sort of bad association of discipline with the military and corporations, and you know, of course, those are awful institutions. But at the same time, you know, there's a reason why militaries use discipline and have things so organized when they go into combat, and it's because it's just that much more effective. And it's pretty hard to pull off an action. Sorry, another plane going overhead here.
Yeah, we can actually hear this one.
Yeah. It's really hard to pull off an action like this. It takes a lot of coordination, communication, people being on the same page. It takes trust, and you know, that takes time to build, and so it really does take a lot of coordination and teamwork.
Right, yeah, and we really appreciate your action. A lot of people have been calling it very exemplary of how things should be done to keep everyone safe and to be effective in making a strong statement that fossil fuel trains shouldn't even be coming through our region still. So we understand that Bellingham might be celebrating quite a bit now that the Lummi have won a favorable decision by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to not provide a permit to SSA Marine for starting construction of the Cherry Point coal export facility, which was supposed to be the largest coal export facility in all of North America, even larger than the one that's where coal dust is blown all around, that's out on an island just west of Vancouver, B.C. What's been happening? I mean, every direct action comes out of a culture, oftentimes out of a frustration with the culture as it stands, the institutions of power, whether they're favoring your view of wanting to stop climate change or not, of those institutions moving too slowly to make changes. Right. What's been going on in Bellingham since this Lummi decision? With, you know, people combating, coal export and you're, Bellingham surrounded by like 3 oil refineries too.
4, I believe.
Yeah, what's happening there?
Well, it's interesting that you bring it up because Bellingham's got a pretty long history of fossil fuel resistance. There was a coal train blockade that I was at, back in, let's see, 2011 or 2012.
Yep, December 2011. Was it the Bellingham 6 or something like that?
Yeah, yeah, a bunch of folks.
Bellingham 12. I apologize.
With UWOCs. And you know, if you go back a little bit further, it wasn't that long ago that a gasoline pipeline running through Bellingham leaked and exploded, caused a huge explosion, killed three young kids who were playing in the park, and destroyed a good section of town in this large park. So, you know, since then, I lived in Bellingham up until about 2011, and was involved in one struggle there. So there's a pipeline running underneath the city that goes down to the Anacortes refineries, and that pipeline carries tar sands fuel. And at the time, we decided to organize around it because the lease with the city for that pipeline was up for renewal. And so we decided to see if we could get the city to, you know, basically just not renew the lease and stop the oil from flowing through this pipeline. And so we organized, we held community events, we went to a bunch of city council meetings. We actually had friends on the city council. And in the end, the city council was all supportive of us. Every single one of the members was supportive you know, was willing to say that they opposed the tar sands and that this was essentially a terrible thing for the planet. But what we ran into, of course, is that it was an issue of interstate commerce. So under the law, as it's currently set up, local communities have no right to turn down a project like that. It's essentially a federal jurisdiction issue. And so we actually knew that going into our organizing, but we wanted people to experience the reality of that, and we wanted to try it, you know, try using our local democracy. And in the end, the city attorney said, if you don't renew this, the city will get sued and they will lose. And so all that's going to happen is the city will lose a bunch of money fighting a lawsuit, and the oil will continue to flow regardless. So that's pretty much the state of local democracy. Even if 100% of the people in Bellingham had voted not to allow this through, it still would have happened under the law. So there were a couple of resolutions passed at the city level as a result of that organizing against tar sands, and Bellingham was the first community in the U.S. to pass any sort of resolutions or laws against the tar sands. Caused a big media outcry in Canada. And you know, people have been organizing against this coal terminal for a long time as well. That was really ramping up just about when I was leaving town. But Spencer, the guy who was arrested on the tripod, he was walking around Bellingham not too long ago, gathering signatures for the Community Bill of Rights, which basically was a project to try and amend local law so that people could do just what I was saying, stop these projects from going through with their local jurisdiction, their local power of self-government. And that was essentially vetoed as well. The local government decided that it would be too difficult to defend against lawsuits from the state or the federal government, and so they decided not to allow that to happen, even though tens of thousands of signatures had been gathered. So, you know, that's not necessarily the fault of local government. That's just how our legal system is set up in this country, is that we don't have local democracy, and people aren't allowed to say no to these projects. So so since the coal terminal was denied, the permit was denied, there's definitely a sense of jubilation. People are really happy about it. That was a big fight. I came up for a bunch of the hearings, and, you know, people did a lot of organizing around that all over the region. And especially the Lummi tribe really took a leadership role. And, you know, for me, it was pretty amazing to see the local indigenous nation taking such a strong stand and a fierce stand against fossil fuels and to defend their land. And, so I think the optimism is definitely guarded, though. You know, the permit was denied, but that doesn't mean that they can't reapply in the future. And I believe this whole Cherry Point export terminal idea has been around for decades. So it's not dead. You know, as often happens with these projects, you think you've got them beat, and they're kind of like the Hydra. They keep coming back. So, you know, I'm interested in doing this organizing work and supporting direct action to stop these projects and community organizing. But, you know, at the same time, I try and always remind myself that we need to be looking for more lasting victories and for ways to actually remove the power of the powerful, so that they can't continue doing what they do, which is destroy the planet and steal from everybody, basically.
Right. Yeah, I guess Whatcom County passed some kind of temporary moratorium on permits for facilities similar to Cherry Point, and that's until they get their comprehensive plan in place, I guess, in January or something. So that'll keep things at bay briefly, but it's always Band-Aids, it seems like, of the local people trying to protect their health and safety and the land that they rely upon, not to mention the waters in places that are sort of fishing base, like the Bellingham Bay community. It's
right.
It's really horrendous to hear after we fought tar sands for so long with all the equipment going up to Canada that, you know, there's a tar sands pipeline under Bellingham Bay. And we all know from the Kalamazoo River spill that if that gets into the water, you can't get that gunk off the bottom. It ruins an entire ecosystem.
Right.
So, yeah, that's really sad that, you know, people could be fishing out of waters that may already have a leaking pipeline in them.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah, and you know, the area where the tripod was actually in Chuckanut Bay, which is just south of Bellingham Bay, and the coal train goes right along there, and, you know, sometimes 3 or 4 trains a day, sometimes 5. And that area is just stunningly beautiful. I mean, still, I mean, we're in a situation where salmon populations are a fraction of their historical numbers, and whale populations are a fraction of their historical numbers, and, you know, 98% of the old growth in the Pacific Northwest has been cut, and, you know, there's so many endangered species, and even those species which aren't endangered, they're experiencing pretty major population declines, whether it's birds or insects or amphibians or whoever else. But, you know, just seeing the beauty of the world, it makes you want to defend it. You know, we were out there in the area, and there was a pod of orca whales that swam by the day before this blockade went down, right by that bay, right where the blockade was. And, you know, I didn't see them, but, you know, I have seen the orcas out there before, and just knowing that these creatures exist, these, you know, creatures who are so different from us, and yet in so many ways they're like us. You know, they live with their families, they love their families and their friends and their social groups. They need healthy, good food, they need clean water, they need places to live, and you know, this culture and industrialism in general is destroying that. And, you know, that, for me, I know, gives me a will to keep fighting and keep protecting.
Right, yeah. It's great to see all the other wonderful lives that we share this planet with that, you know, and it seems like they constantly reach out to us to communicate and just to connect, and people don't pay enough attention to that, I think. It's coming up on about a half an hour, and I'm wondering if you would like to share any last thoughts about and encouragements about how to effectively stage good, strong actions like this, since I know there's a lot of people all across the Northwest that would love to pull off similar, sort of just locally focused actions that are still nonetheless strong. I guess,
right.
You know, necessarily we can't all you know, put together huge actions like what happened in mid-May and right. March Point near Anacortes, but that we have to rely on our own social groups and affinity groups to do actions that are, they have to necessarily sort of be hidden in advance just because that's the only way you can get around the authorities and actually pull it off.
Right.
So, and therefore it's even hard to coordinate with each other across the region. But,
right.
How, you know, what's the best way to go about these things? Because a lot of people are really admiring this action that happened there in Bellingham on Chuckanuck Bay or in the Bellingham area. What would you advise how, for people to do similar things?
Well, I would say for one, just set up secure communication now. You know, don't wait until you need it to set it up, whether that's encrypted email or, you know, phone apps like Signal or various things. There are a lot of different encrypted communication options available these days. And just set those up with your friends and get in the habit of using them. Because when you need them, you don't want to be fumbling around trying to figure out how to get used to a new system. That can really enable communication. So that's one thing I would say. The other thing I would say is there's no such thing as over-planning for an action like this. Well, maybe there is, but it would be hard to over-plan. I think it's really worth just for, you know, a long time in advance, doing a lot of thinking and writing and brainstorming and thinking about different concerns, different issues, having discussions, and, you know, consulting maps. I think that local action can really become magnified by knowledge of the terrain and knowledge of the land. And, you know, essentially it's not that dissimilar from guerrilla warfare. You know, we are small, in terms of numbers. We don't have much resources. We don't have much money. So we've got to try and maximize what we do have. And one of the best ways to do that is to use the terrain to your advantage. So whether that means, you know, trying to go in a certain type of weather, which will make it more difficult for the authorities to deal with you or, you know, using the terrain in such a way, as happened at this blockade, that they can only get at you from certain directions. And I think just being creative as well, you know, and not getting stuck in the idea that we have to do something like it was done in the past. But, you know, instead thinking we always have to be innovating and, you know, the other side is pouring resources into the struggle. And I think we have to be doing the same in terms of our creativity and our energy and what we can come up with to sort of take another step forward in the arms race, you know, of nonviolent civil disobedience. How can we escalate a little bit? And, you know, I think it's worth staying in touch with legal support so that you can get advice. There are activist lawyer groups like the National Lawyers Guild and Civil Liberties Defense Center that can provide advice about hypothetical actions. Or hypothetical charges that might happen beforehand, so people know what they're getting into. And yeah, just I would say, you know, I was up in Anacortes for the Break Free action, and it was really great to see. It was a great, huge event, and ended up cooking a bunch of salmon for people that the Swinomish Nation provided. Stepped in to help in the kitchen, and was out at the blockade for a long time, it was a wonderful action, but at the same time, I feel like if we're going to have 52 people be arrested, maybe let's try and get the most bang for our buck. And I don't say that in any way to denigrate what people did there, because I think it's great. And, you know, we need actions like that that are big and public and, you know, big protests and rallies just to get people excited and meeting each other and so on. But at the same time, it's great to think, okay, how can we maximize our impact per number of people that get arrested? Because each person that gets arrested is time and energy and money that's essentially sunk for a while. You know, how do we organize our actions in such a way that after each action we're stronger than we were beforehand? So it doesn't actually drain our energy and drain our finances and time, but it actually gives us more. It helps us build and get bigger and stronger. So those are a few things that just come to mind when I think about actions.
All right. That's some great advice. And of course, we always, everyone who stages actions like this hopes that it inspires all of our comrades across the region to use similar measures, and to always, of course, keep our much more powerful adversaries guessing what's coming next. We just really want to thank you for sharing all your wisdom with us. And if you have anything else you want to say, we just want to say thanks again.
Okay, well, yeah, I'll just say thanks so much for having me on. And if people want to support, there's a legal support fundraiser going around, Deep Green Resistance Seattle. And thank you for all your work over the years. I've been following the Megalode resistance for a lot of years now, and really support what y'all have been doing up there. So thanks a lot.
All right. Well, thank you, Max. And, of course, we've been talking with Max Wilbert of Deep Green Resistance Seattle and talking about the recent very successful blockade just south of Bellingham on rail lines, BNSF rail lines carrying coal trains up to an export facility in Vancouver, B.C. So thanks again, and we'll keep in touch, and keep up your great work, and tell everyone else that was involved in this that we're super grateful for everything they've done to pull this off.
Thanks, Ellen.
All right, thanks.